The radar screen lights up just after dawn. A long, slow-moving tanker cuts across warm Caribbean water, its course tight to the edge of Venezuelan influence. A U.S. Coast Guard cutter closes the distance. Radios crackle. Lawyers and diplomats are already awake. This is not a rescue. It is not a routine inspection. The vessel is tied to U.S. sanctions, its oil cargo linked to a government for Washington is trying to choke financially. Every mile matters. Every decision risks turning enforcement into escalation. On one side, a Coast Guard crew trained to act, bound by law, and conscious of cameras and consequences. On the other, a civilian ship crew navigating orders they did not write, sailing through a geopolitical fault line. Nearby nations watch quietly, weighing trade routes, insurance costs, and sovereignty. The chase is slow, the pressure is not. What happens next will ripple far beyond this stretch of sea. Chapter 1. The Intercept Line. The alert comes in before sunrise, routed through quiet channels that do not blink or buzz. It lands in an operations room where screens glow blue and coffee goes cold fast. A tanker is moving through the southern Caribbean, heavy with crude, its course brushing close to Venezuelan waters. It is not just another ship. It is flagged in databases tied to U.S. sanctions. Out at sea, a U.S. Coast Guard cutter adjusts course. The vessel is already underway on a regional security patrol, part of a broader effort aimed at narcotics, trafficking, and sanctions enforcement. The crew does not know yet how this will end. They know only that the order is to locate, track, and assess. The Caribbean is calm that morning, but calm can be misleading. Tankers do not move fast, neither do political consequences. The cutter closes distance at a measured pace. This is not a chase with sirens or speed. It is a slow tightening of space. On the bridge, officers review what they have. The tanker's name appears in maritime tracking systems. Its ownership traces through layers of shell companies. The flag state raises questions. None of this is accidental. Vessels carrying sanctioned oil rarely advertise it. They drift through gray zones, relying on ambiguity, paperwork, and time. The Coast Guard operates under clear rules, but those rules live inside a maze of law. U.S. sanctions authorize enforcement against certain entities and cargoes. Maritime law governs how and when vessels may be approached. International waters complicate everything. So does proximity to another nation's claimed sphere of influence. The cutter's legal officer is already working through scenarios. Is the tanker within international waters? Does it present sufficient cause for boarding? Is there a clear nexus to sanctioned entities? Each answer matters. Each mistake could echo far beyond the deck. As the cutter draws closer, radar confirms visual range. The tanker looms large on the horizon, a steel island carrying millions of barrels of oil. Its crew goes about routine tasks. From their vantage point, the approaching cutter is impossible to miss. The first radio call is professional and restrained. Identification requested, course confirmed. The tanker responds. Voices remain calm. No one raises tone. This is how serious situations begin, when everyone knows what is at stake. The Coast Guard does not accuse, not yet. It states intent to conduct a law enforcement inquiry. The phrasing is deliberate. It signals authority without threat. It also leaves room for maneuver. Inside the tanker's bridge, decisions are being made just as carefully. The crew did not design the sanctions regime. They did not choose the ownership structure. They are sailors paid to move cargo from one port to another. Now they are sitting at the edge of a geopolitical contest. The cutter maintains distance. Boarding teams are not deployed. Cameras roll quietly. Every exchange is recorded. Documentation will matter later, long after the ship changes course or sails away. This is where the tension lives, not in raised voices or dramatic turns, but in restraint. One wrong signal, one misunderstood instruction, one misstep could be framed as provocation. The Coast Guard commander knows the headlines that could follow. A U.S. vessel intercepting a tanker near Venezuela will not go unnoticed. It will be read in Caracas, Washington, and capitals across the Caribbean. It will be analyzed for intent. The legal basis for action is solid on paper. The tanker is believed to be carrying oil linked to sanctioned Venezuelan entities. U.S. policy aims to cut off revenue streams that support the government in Caracas. Maritime enforcement is one of the few tools that reach beyond borders. But paper authority does not neutralize real-world risk. The Caribbean is crowded. Commercial shipping lanes pass nearby. Regional nations depend on oil flows and stable routes. Any disruption sends signals through markets and insurance firms. Weather begins to shift. Wind picks up slightly. Nothing dangerous, but enough to complicate small boat operations if boarding becomes necessary. The cutter adjusts position again, maintaining a line that allows control without confrontation. On shore, analysts track the situation through open source data and quiet briefings. The tanker's path is already being discussed in think tanks and government offices. Social media remains silent for now, but that will not last if the situation escalates. The Coast Guard requests additional documentation from the tanker, bills of lading, destination information, ownership declarations. The answers come back slowly. Some details align, others raise flags. This is the gray zone where sanctions enforcement lives. Rarely is there a single document that settles everything. Instead, there is accumulation, patterns, associations, enough to justify further action or enough to pull back. The cutter's crew feels the pressure, even if they do not speak it aloud. They are trained for drug interdictions that move fast and end hard. This is different. This is chess at sea. Venezuelan waters sit not far away. The line is invisible, but everyone knows where it is. Crossing it without cause would change the nature of the encounter instantly. Staying just outside keeps the situation contained, at least for now. The tanker holds its course. It does not attempt to flee. That alone is telling. Vessels with nothing to hide often cooperate fully. Vessels with too much at stake sometimes do the same, betting that compliance will buy time or a favorable decision. Hours pass. The sun climbs, heat settles in, the cutter maintains presence, the tanker remains under observation, lawyers ashore weigh in, diplomats are notified. The question is no longer whether the tanker is sanctioned. The question is how far the United States is willing to go to enforce that status at sea, in this place, at this moment. The Caribbean has seen enforcement actions before. Drug seizures, human trafficking interdictions. This feels different because oil sits at the center of state power, because Venezuela's economy depends on it, because every move is read as pressure. The Coast Guard commander receives updated guidance. The operation remains law enforcement, not military. Language matters. Conduct matters more. The cutter edges closer again, not enough to crowd, enough to remind the tanker it is not alone. The radio comes alive once more. This time the stakes sharpen. The Coast Guard signals potential next steps, conditional and careful. Boarding is mentioned, not ordered. Authority is asserted, not enforced. The tanker responds with caution, it acknowledges, it asks questions, it delays. This is the intercept line, the place where law meets power, where sailors become symbols, where a slow-moving ship carries more than oil. It carries consequence. No one yet knows how this will end. But everyone involved understands that once the next decision is made, there is no clean rewind. Chapter 2. Sanctions, Sovereignty, and Pressure. The pursuit does not stay at sea. It spreads outward, carried by statements, silence, and calculation. As word reaches government offices and shipping desks, the incident is no longer just a question of one tanker. It becomes a test of policy. The sanctions framework sits at the center of it. For years, Washington has used financial restrictions to limit Venezuela's ability to sell oil, its main source of hard currency. The measures target state entities, intermediaries, and buyers who move crude through indirect routes. Enforcement has usually played out in banks and ports. Interdiction at sea raises the stakes. Officials in Caracas move first, publicly at least. They frame the pursuit as an act of aggression, a violation of sovereignty carried out under the banner of law enforcement. State media amplifies the message. The narrative is clear. The United States is accused of using sanctions as a pretext to project power into the Caribbean. The language is sharp but measured. There is no call to arms, no naval response announced. That restraint is intentional. Venezuela's leadership understands the imbalance at sea. It also understands the value of framing. The goal is political pressure, not confrontation. In Washington, the tone is different but equally deliberate. U.S. officials emphasize legality. They cite sanctions authority, maritime law, and the need to enforce rules consistently. The pursuit is described as a law enforcement action, not a military maneuver. Words are chosen to cool, not inflame. Behind closed doors, the concern is escalation by accident. One boarding gone wrong, one misinterpreted maneuver. The Caribbean may look calm on a map, but it is crowded with commercial traffic and overlapping claims. Regional governments watch closely. Most do not issue statements. Silence becomes its own signal. Caribbean nations depend on stable shipping lanes and predictable enforcement. They also guard their sovereignty carefully. No one wants to be drawn into a confrontation between Washington and Caracas. Port authorities begin to assess risk. Insurance firms do the same. Any suggestion that sanctioned oil could be intercepted near their waters triggers calculations. Premiums are adjusted quietly. Routes are reconsidered. Schedules shift. Shipping companies feel the pressure first. Oil traders ask questions they cannot answer with certainty. Is this a new enforcement posture or a one-time signal? Will tankers be stopped elsewhere? Will insurers cover delays caused by interdictions? Some vessels alter course. Not dramatically, but enough to avoid proximity to contested zones. Others slow down, waiting for clarity. Time becomes a cost. Fuel burns. Contracts strain. The economic effects ripple outward without headlines. Refineries waiting for feedstock adjust output. Buyers look for alternative suppliers. None of this appears dramatic on its own, but together it tightens the system. U.S. officials defend the operation in briefings that avoid detail. They stress that sanctions have consequences and that enforcement is essential to credibility. They also stress that civilian crews are not the target. The focus is on networks, not sailors. That distinction matters. It allows Washington to claim moral high ground while applying pressure. It also leaves room to step back if the costs outweigh the gains. Caracas pushes its message through regional forums. It frames the pursuit as part of a broader pattern of coercion. Allies echo the concern. Critics point out that sanctions enforcement has long included maritime elements. The argument circles without resolution. Diplomatic channels heat up. Ambassadors request explanations. Legal teams exchange notes. No one wants to be caught off guard if the situation shifts. Inside the shipping industry, the message is clearer. The sea is no longer neutral ground when oil is involved. Compliance departments expand their watch lists. Brokers add clauses. The gray zone shrinks. For smaller Caribbean economies, the implications are uneasy. They rely on imported fuel. They rely on predictable trade. Any disruption threatens inflation and political stability at home. Yet speaking out risks angering powerful partners. Analysts begin to weigh in publicly. Some argue that firm enforcement deters illicit trade and stabilizes the system in the long run. Others warn that pushing sanctions to the waterline increases the risk of miscalculation. The comparison to past enforcement actions surfaces quickly. Drug interdictions rarely provoke diplomatic crises because there is broad consensus on illegality. Oil sanctions do not enjoy that consensus. They sit inside contested policy space. Markets respond subtly. Oil prices flicker. Traders factor in risk premiums. No one attributes the movement to a single pursuit, but the context matters. The pressure is asymmetric. The United States can absorb trade shifts and diplomatic protests. Venezuela feels each enforcement action more acutely. That imbalance is part of the strategy. It is also part of the criticism. As days pass, the incident remains unresolved publicly. That uncertainty feeds speculation, even as officials refuse to comment. Silence becomes a tool. Regional media begins to connect dots. Past seizures, past warnings, a pattern is suggested. Whether that pattern is real or perceived matters less than the belief that it exists. In private, U.S. officials debate next steps. Strong enforcement signals resolve, but risks backlash. Restraint preserves stability, but may weaken sanctions credibility. There is no clean answer. The tanker at the center of it all fades into abstraction. It becomes a symbol used by both sides, a floating argument about law, power, and limits. The Caribbean itself feels smaller under that weight. What was once open water becomes a stage. Every movement is watched. Every decision is read for intent. The question shifts. It is no longer only about this vessel or this cargo. It is about whether sanctions enforcement at sea stabilizes behavior or accelerates confrontation. No one answers it yet. The pressure continues to build, slow and steady, like heat beneath the surface. Chapter 3. After the wake, the conclusion comes quietly, without spectacle. No dramatic boarding captured on shaky footage. No confrontation that forces an immediate reckoning. The pursuit ends through a defined decision shaped by law, risk, and calculation rather than force. The tanker alters course under monitored conditions. The outcome is confirmed through official channels only after it is settled. Depending on the legal determination, the vessel is either diverted, released, or allowed to proceed under restrictions that signal enforcement without ignition. The details matter less than the message sent by the process itself. U.S. officials frame the result carefully. They describe it as consistent with sanctions authority and maritime law. They emphasize restraint. They stress that escalation was avoided by design, not by chance. The language is firm but controlled. Caracas responds in kind, declaring the outcome a vindication of sovereignty or proof of overreach, depending on the framing. The statements are predictable. What matters more is what does not happen. There is no naval response, no retaliatory seizure. The temperature drops slightly. The Coast Guard cutter resumes patrol. The crew does not celebrate. There is nothing to celebrate. They log hours, document communications, and return to routine operations that now feel heavier than before. They understand they were part of something larger than interdiction. Behind them, the wake spreads. In shipping circles, the incident becomes a reference point. Compliance officers cite it in briefings. Insurers adjust language and policies. Brokers advise caution near enforcement zones that were once treated as background risk. The Caribbean map changes subtly, not in borders, but in behavior. For regional governments, the lesson is complicated. The pursuit demonstrates that sanctions enforcement can reach into shared waters without crossing formal lines. It also shows restraint is still possible. Both facts are unsettling in different ways. Some ports quietly enhance screening procedures. Others avoid comment entirely. No one wants to be the next focal point of a geopolitical test case. Trade impacts surface slowly. Delays ripple through supply chains. Costs are absorbed, passed on, or disguised as market fluctuation. Consumers never hear the tanker's name, but they feel its shadow in higher prices and tighter margins. Analysts debate whether the incident represents a shift or a reminder. One camp argues that maritime enforcement is becoming a more prominent tool as financial routes tighten. Another insists this was situational, driven by specific intelligence and timing. Both views miss something. The real change is psychological. Before, sanctions enforcement at sea was possible. Now it is tangible. That distinction matters to actors who operate in gray zones. It narrows room for maneuver. It increases the cost of risk. It forces choices earlier in the chain before ships leave port and paperwork is filed. For Venezuela, the outcome reinforces existing pressure without resolving it. Oil continues to move, but under watchful eyes. Revenue remains constrained. The leadership adjusts rhetoric and tactics, not objectives. For Washington, the incident tests credibility. Enforcement without escalation strengthens the claim that sanctions are lawful and controlled. It also raises expectations. Once a line is drawn, it must be defended consistently or explained when it is not. Consistency is hard in a region shaped by shifting alliances and economic fragility. Each future enforcement decision will be measured against this one. Caribbean sovereignty debates sharpen. Scholars and policymakers revisit questions that have lingered for decades. Who controls enforcement in international waters adjacent to small states? How power asymmetries shape legality in practice, where law ends and influence begins. No consensus emerges, but the conversation gains urgency. The Coast Guard's role comes under renewed scrutiny. Traditionally seen as humanitarian and law enforcement focused, it is now viewed through a strategic lens by some observers. That perception carries weight regardless of intent. Within the service, training and guidance evolve quietly. Legal briefings emphasize documentation and restraint. Commanders are reminded that every action may be read far beyond the deck. The tanker fades from headlines. Its crew returns to anonymity. Their experience becomes anecdote, not history. Yet the incident lingers in policy rooms. The Caribbean does not erupt into crisis. That absence is itself an outcome. Avoided escalation counts, even if it does not make news. What remains unresolved is the boundary between enforcement and provocation. That line is not fixed. It moves with politics, markets, and perception. Future tankers will sail with this incident in mind, so will future cutters. The sea stays the same, warm, busy, and different. But the space above it feels tighter now, filled with expectations and warnings that did not exist before. Power has left a mark, not through force, but through presence. The question going forward is not whether similar pursuits will happen again. It is how often, how visibly, and with what restraint. In the Caribbean, that answer will shape trade, diplomacy, and sovereignty long after this wake disappears.